MacCast, Wednesday, February 11th, 2015. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I am getting ready to head out of town. I'm about to go on vacation for about a week, but don't worry. I've got MacCast already lined up and scheduled for you. Something a bit special. I won't give away too much except to say that it's something I did with some friends or amigos, but stay tuned for that. That should be coming next week. But for now, I've got a great show for you today. We got lots of stuff to talk about. Several things going on in the Apple and Mac world these days. Apple's got some new green initiatives that they are working on that we're going to talk about. We're gearing up and prepping for Apple Watch. Updates to iOS 8 and OS 10 are in the works. We'll talk a little bit about those. And a mystery vehicle driving around that seems to belong to Apple has led to a lot of speculation. You probably saw that one this week. And new plans for Beats Music that we're hearing about. So we'll talk about all of that in the Apple news and then get into some of your feedback and questions. Talk a little bit about activation locks and that lost iPhone mode. I had a little issue with unrecoverable iTunes purchases. We're going to talk about what happened and how you cannot fall into the same trap that I did. And also issues exporting slow motion video. A number of you ran into that problem, and it's something that I've struggled with as well. So we're going to talk about how you can handle that. And a question about antivirus and the Mac. So stay tuned for all of that. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Audible. I have been a Audible subscriber forever. I love audiobooks. I think they are great for all sorts of things. One in particular, I mentioned I'm going to be traveling here. Great way to enjoy a book on the plane as you're traveling. You can catch up with your favorite authors. You can discover something new. And Audible's awesome because they have just a ton of selection. Their library is huge, over 150,000 titles across every imaginable category. So no matter what you're into, fiction, nonfiction, historical stuff, fantasy, sci-fi, horror, they've got it all. And I've never had any issues finding anything that I want on Audible. They even have exclusive titles that you're not going to find on any other service. And what's great is the books that you buy, you own. They're saved in your library. You can download them and listen to them on any of your devices, iPhone, iPod, Android, Kindle Fire, Windows Phone, over 500 different MP3 players. The choices are endless. And they also have their iOS and Android apps, which are really great because if you're also a Kindle book reader, if you have the same title on the Kindle or in the Kindle app, they have this technology called Whisper Sync for Voice. And that lets you switch back and forth between reading and listening. Another great thing for travel. So you got your Kindle there. Maybe you want to read for a little bit. You get to a certain point. Maybe, you know, your eyes are getting tired and you just want to pick up and now you want to listen to it. You can jump right into the same book on Audible at the same point using the Whisper Sync technology. And the best part of all is you can try out Audible for free for 30 days and get a free audiobook in the process. So you can get the whole experience. If you've never tried it before, I don't know what you're waiting for. You really should. And if you're worried about which book to get, you don't have to worry about that either because Audible has the great listen guarantee. So if you decide that the book you chose wasn't quite the right book for you, you can exchange it and you can get another title anytime, no questions asked. So you don't have to worry about that. Plus, they have great previews. You can kind of listen. You'll start to find certain readers that Audible uses, and they have great readers presenting the content. You'll find your favorite ones, and you'll want to pick up books just based on who the reader is. And another thing that I would recommend to you, if you're not sure what book to get, we know the new Steve Jobs movie based on the Walter Isaacson biography is going to be coming out in October. So now would be a perfect time to catch up with that or maybe re-listen to it as you get ready to watch the film. And you can pick that up or any other title from their huge library right now. All you have to do is go to audiblepodcast.com/MacCast and sign up. It's really that easy. You'll get 30 days to try it out, free audiobook. Love Audible, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So let's get into the Apple news. This week, we're hearing some reports on Apple's green initiatives. Tim Cook and company are doing a few interesting things. One is that Apple appears to be making good on their promise to do something about that failed GT Advanced Sapphire Glass plant or factory in Mesa, Arizona. Word came this week that Apple plans to invest over $2 billion in the facility over the next 10 years, and they're going to turn it into a global command center for their data centers. So they're going to build a data center facility. They're saying it's going to become the hub for their other four locations based in the U.S. So they have the Made in North Carolina. They have the one in Oregon. Pineville. I'm getting the name wrong, I know. Sorry, Oregonians. And then the other data center is escaping me right now. I'm sure it'll come back to me as I'm reading this report. But one thing Apple promised to do when GT Advanced failed and jobs were lost in the region is they said that they would invest, they would do something to bring some of those jobs back. And according to Apple, when they make this investment in the new data center, by the time it's completed, it'll add over 600 engineering and construction jobs. Now, that sounds like a lot. They got to give you, all sides of the story. 300 to 500 of those jobs are going to be created during construction, and the facility itself is going to create 150 full-time positions. And while it's great the construction is going to generate so many jobs, those aren't necessarily permanent positions. The 150 permanent positions at the new data center does kind of fall short of replacing the over 600 positions that were lost when GT Advanced shut its doors. But it's going to bring all kinds of other advantages to that area and to the region. And for Arizona, the state of Arizona was particularly excited. I mean, the good news here is Apple didn't just abandon the facility. They're actually going to do something with it. And not only that, like all of their other data centers, they're going to make sure that they're using green energy. So Apple has pledged that the facility will use 100% renewable energy sources, and they're going to help finance and build a new 70 megawatt solar power farm to help with that effort. So there's additional jobs and things that they're going to generate while they're putting that facility together. And Apple, unfortunately, is still waiting for GT Advanced to sell off the large sapphire furnaces that are housed there. They're doing that to pay back some of the debt that they owe Apple. And so the construction and all of the stuff on the new facility is not expected to start until late 2016. It could possibly be earlier, but it's going to be a little bit delayed. So that's the first thing that's happening. The other thing that was announced was Tim Cook said that Apple plans to build a massive $850 million solar farm in Monterey County, California. He made the announcement during the Goldman Sachs technology conference call that they did just, I think it was yesterday as I'm recording this podcast. And they stated that it's Apple's biggest and boldest, most ambitious project ever. It's a 1,300-acre project, and Cook says it's going to generate enough power for nearly 60,000 California homes. And 9to5Mac noted that the facility is generating enough power to offset all of Apple's California operations, including its 55 retail stores, its under construction campus too, and its offices in California, along with at least one of its data centers. So I don't think Apple has a data center in California, but enough power to offset the energy usage for all of those facilities. The project is in partnership with First Solar, and Apple will receive electricity under a 25-year power purchase agreement with the company, getting 130 megawatts of solar power from the project. Now, Macworld notes that this doesn't mean that the Apple stores or offices are going to consume the power directly from the plant. They say it's likely the benefit is by Apple locking in a low fixed rate on the renewable energy. And probably also they will be able to obtain renewable energy certificates to actually offset their carbon footprint. So there's different advantages. I'm not really clear on how the whole process worked. We talked a little bit about this with Victor Cahiao and David Sparks on that thing that I alluded to earlier. So you'll hear more of us talking about that in the next episode of the MacCast. I think the gist is that the facility is in Monterey County. Obviously, Apple's new campus, too, is in Cupertino, but the energy goes into the grid and, you know, they're basically getting the power from that renewable source, if not directly. So I'm not sure how all of that works. If you happen to know, it wasn't really clear from the stuff that I was reading. So I'd love to kind of know, you know, from somebody who works in the power industry more how all of this stuff works, specifically if you're in the solar industry and can kind of enlighten us. That would be great. If you'd like to email in or send in an audio comment, let me know. And I'm going to do more research on this as I can figure it out. I'll try and maybe better explain how it works. I'm a little confused at this point, but the good news is that Apple is really committed to renewable energy. I think Tim Cook has shown that under his leadership, Apple is being a lot more forward about their green initiatives, about being more environmentally conscious. And, you know, I think that's not only goodwill, but it's good for the environment, and it's just good all the way around. So great to see them continuing those efforts this week. The Apple Watch is coming. Are you excited? I am totally stoked. I am ready to get my hands on this thing, see what it can do. We're starting to hear how Apple is making plans for the actual selling, what's happening at retail stores. Sources claim that with all the gold that Apple is going to be housing in their retail stores when that Apple Edition watch arrives, that's the 18-karat gold model, they have to significantly beef up security from what they have now. You know, over the years, we've had and seen break-ins at Apple retail stores. I think with all that gold lying around, they're going to become a bigger target, and Apple is aware of that. We're hearing what they're going to do to plan. Basically, overnight, they're going to become really high-end jewelry stores as well as computer electronics stores, and they need safe storage to go along with that. So the reports we're hearing is that Apple is planning to add these specially designed safes that will be able to keep the inventory safe and protect it, as well as keep the display units overnight. And these safes sound really cool. They've got technology built into them. They're going to contain Apple Watch MagSafe chargers so that when the demo units go in overnight, they're going to be charged up, ready for display the next day. I would assume only select employees are going to have access. There's probably going to be all kinds of monitoring, maybe even inventory control systems built into them. I would imagine these things are going to be some of the most high-tech safes you've ever seen. Love to get my eyes on one of them, but, you know, they're going to be in the back of the house. The employees can maybe fill us in. Maybe we'll get some leaked pictures and stuff like that. I look forward to seeing those, but it sounds really cool. But not just the back of the house is changing. We're also hearing about the sales floor and the selling process for the Apple Watch. It's reportedly bringing some big changes in Apple retail. Apple is getting ready to kind of reorganize the Apple Store shelving areas to make room for the Apple Watch and display tables. I would imagine they're going to get a prominent position within the stores. They're also supposedly training employees and developing ways to better demonstrate the Apple Watch. This really is a different buying experience. The whole process of buying jewelry, trying on different bands, demonstrating features and benefits to customers, they're going to get training on that. Things like the ability to buy the different styles and different options, a lot's going to go into making that purchase decision, especially on the higher end. So I would expect to see a lot more personal service, maybe more people on the floor, which is going to be hard with the limited amount of retail space that, you know, a lot of Apple stores have. So it'll be interesting to see how they're going to handle it. Apple is planning on sending, it sounds like, 2 employees from each store or from many of their stores to training sessions, either in Cupertino or in Austin, Texas. And then what's supposed to happen is those employees are going to go back and train the employees at their local retail stores. So I think Apple's taking this effort really seriously on the retail front. In addition to the changes for Apple Watch, it's also being said that retail chief Angela Arendt plans some other possible changes. One of them is the addition of new seating areas where customers can go into the Apple stores, sit and relax. This would be great for people who are maybe stuck waiting on a Genius Bar appointment. If you've ever been in an Apple retail store, you know what I'm talking about. They've got those kind of hard stools that people hang around at or just leaning up against a table. It'd be nice to have a more comfortable area to sit down in. But again, they have space limitations at a lot of the retail stores, so I would guess that not every store is going to get the new kind of seating. Apple is reportedly, I guess, preparing a pilot program in select stores in the U.S. and Europe, something that we should be seeing this spring. Another small change that we heard about this month was that Apple retail store employees are going back to their blue shirts. I think they've had red for a while. It's either going to be a crew neck or a polo shirt, long or short sleeved. So they have all of these options. I think the employees kind of get to pick. They have a smaller Apple logo centered over the heart. So that's another change. Another sad one that I heard about today was that we may be seeing the Genius Bar logo going away. So changes up at the Genius Bar. I'm not sure why they'd be getting rid of the logo, but maybe that's in relationship to what they're doing with the presentation of the Apple Watch. I don't know if they're going to have, you know, Apple Watches out on tables or if they're going to have display cases more like a jewelry store. Only time's going to tell on that. We haven't heard a lot of the specifics, but I'm sure we can expect some significant changes in Apple retail as we get closer to the Apple Watch launch. Also coming down the pike is updates to iOS 8 and OS 10. We're starting to hear about the next versions of those operating systems, and not just the next version, but the next, and next if you're talking about iOS 8. iOS 8 adoption rates have been good, and they continue to kind of rise, but they still are trailing behind the adoption rate of iOS 7. And I think part of that reason is that iOS 8 got off to a little bit of a rocky start. People were a little bit leery to upgrade. The latest numbers from the App Store distribution data show that 72% of iOS devices are now running iOS 8, with a quarter of devices running iOS 7 and just 3% of users using older operating systems, iOS 6 and earlier. For comparison, iOS 7 reached about 85% adoption rate over a similar period of time when it was released in 2013. So not too far behind with iOS 8 adoption, but significant, and I think Apple wants to change that. To that end, we're seeing them kind of push out aggressive updates to iOS 8. Apple released iOS 8.3 beta to developers this past week, and no, you didn't miss the 8.2 update. If you're looking at your iPhone going, oh, but I'm on 8.1, where'd 8.2 go? 8.2, the fifth beta version of that, was just released to developers the week before they put out 8.3. Now, 8.3 removes the beta label from iCloud Photo Library, and it also brings in new wireless CarPlay features and a new scrollable emoji picker with different categories. 8.3 also came with Xcode 6.3 beta, which has Swift 1.2, which is Apple's new programming language for building apps, and Swift is said to have big changes in performance and improvements for the development platform. And then Xcode 6.3 also has enhancements that are supposed to ease interoperability between Swift and Objective-C code. So, you know, Apple, I think, trying to make the transition from Objective-C to Swift a little bit easier, a little bit more compatible for developers. And then Mac Rumors also claims that they're seeing iOS 8.4 in their logs. Because that hasn't been released to developers, it's likely Apple internal builds. So that's in early stages of production. So you can see how they're sort of lining up the chain of iOS releases. And Apple's been aggressive about this in the past, but in looking at these rumors, I think this is more aggressive than I've ever seen them being. So I would fully expect with 8.2 out there in its fifth version of the beta, we should see that release relatively soon, quickly followed by updates to 8.3 with developers, and then followed along by 8.4. So we don't have a lot of details on what's going on with 8.4, but one speculation is that it may bring a new updated Beats music service to iOS, and we'll have a little bit more on that later. And even looking further out than that, we're also hearing some rumors that iOS 9 could be mostly focused on no new features, being a no new features release, focusing mainly on stabilizing and optimizing the operating system. At least that's what 9 to 5 Mac says. They say the release is codenamed Monarch, and Apple is putting a huge focus on fixing bugs, maintaining stability, and boosting performance, something that I think none of us would be disappointed with. I know iOS 8 got a little bit of a bad rap, but I think with 8.1 point, what are we on, 2 or 3, with this latest version, I think Apple's addressed a lot of the issues that I've been having. I don't know about you, and I fully expect with 8.2, 8.3, things are only going to get much better. But it's always great to see Apple kind of have a year with the operating system where they're really focusing on refining and fine-tuning. You know, 8 was a big update, and I think that wouldn't be time, or that would be rather time well spent. And OS X Yosemite didn't want to get left out of the update party. There was a release out to developers, 10.10.3 beta. And the big news there is Apple finally gave us our first look at the new Photos application. Photos has a new, cleaner Yosemite-style look. If you remember, Photos is going to replace iPhoto and Aperture. It brings that white, transparent Yosemite style to the Photos application. And while I do like the consistency and the clean look, I think it's probably not the most ideal motif for viewing photos. And I kind of hope or wish they would add a dark option. I like looking at photos on a dark background so you don't get any kind of color shifts and things like that. According to Jason Snell, as far as the UI goes, he thinks that Apple has built this on top of something called UX Kit. He's hearing that from developers. They're saying it's somewhat similar to what they have on iOS, the UI Kit, and there really hasn't been anything similar on the Mac before. So this may be a sign that Apple is adding some new developer tools on the user interface side, and UX Kit could make it easier to kind of bridge the divide between iOS and Mac apps. So maybe making it easier for developers to take their Mac apps and bring them over to iOS and their iOS apps and bring them into Mac OS, or at least do that kind of integration and maintain a similar kind of look and language, which I think is overall a good thing just for continuity and consistency. And we know with iOS 8 OS X Yosemite, that is something Apple has been particularly focused on over the last year or so. Getting back to the Photos application, it has tabs at the top now instead of a default sidebar. Now, the sidebar is still there. It's hidden by default. You can turn it back on. But when the sidebar is off, you basically get tabs at the top for your different sections. So things like Photos, your shared tab, albums, and projects. And then when you dock in a device, the import tab appears. And so that's, you know, getting back to that kind of one window view of the application, moving away from our traditional sort of sidebar, title bar, you know, three pane view that we've had with, you know, things like iPhoto in the past. Now, scrolling and navigating large libraries is said to be vastly improved, something that I think a lot of us will be very happy about with iPhones and iPads and everything having a camera on it. We're taking more and more photos. Those libraries are getting larger and larger. And honestly, iPhoto, I think, was having trouble keeping up. I wasn't a big Aperture user, so I don't know on that side, but I think we'd also heard complaints to that end. So anytime Apple can improve scrolling and navigating performance in an app like that, I think that's a welcome addition. As far as how photos are presented in the new application, it's very iOS-like in terms of the organization. So you have your years, your collections and moments, and you kind of drill in or expand out of those views. There is the shared section, which is where you're going to access your iCloud photo shares and your photo stream. It's also where, if you turn on iCloud photo library, you will access your iCloud photo library images, but that is not required. You do not have to activate that feature. It's just an option. So that's good to see, because you know, every Apple pushing all of those photos, those huge photo libraries, into the cloud. Obviously, you're gonna run out of storage. You're gonna have to pay for more, and not everybody's gonna want to have to do that. As far as the albums go, there are some special albums in there. That's where everything is kind of getting moved to. Like I said, the sidebar is off by default. So if you need to get at things like Faces or your last import or your favorites, those are all in there. You also have, you know, access to things like your panorama photos, your videos, your slow-mo, your time lapses, your bursts. So all those special albums that help you organize or automatically organize those types of photos. And then, of course, any personal albums that you've created, you can go in there. An interesting change that I noted from some of the reports and images that showed up online, it looks like the info panel is no longer locked down into the application. It's no longer a right sidebar. It's now a standard floating palette, which I think for me is going to be a welcome change. I like to be able to move that thing around. And the editing tools, when you go into editing mode, look very iOS 8-like to me. They have that dark look. So this is one area where they do flip on the dark mode. Again, I think that's very important, especially if you're doing color adjustments and things like that. The tools themselves look really great. The adjustments have this great little preview slider. So kind of under the little slider bar, you actually get a preview image of a range of what applying that adjustment will look like. It's a little small, but I think it works. And the early community impressions seem to be generally positive for the new Photos application. So a lot of the blogs, the people who are getting their hands on this and reporting on it are really saying that they actually like a lot of the changes and adjustments. So it's not kind of getting the negative press that maybe Final Cut got, but that may be because we haven't heard a lot from the pro market yet. And I think those folks are going to be a little bit disappointed. Just like with the first version of Final Cut 10, the Photos application does appear to be lacking some of the pro features. It looks and feels very much iPhoto-like. It's like iPhoto enhanced as opposed to aperture kind of light or aperture brought down to a broader prosumer market. So I fully expect we'll be hearing from jilted aperture users. I think they've seen the writing on the wall, though. A lot of them have already jumped ship and moved off on to Lightroom. But if you're a pro user using aperture and you were wondering, I would say, you know, run, don't crawl, you know, just get over to Lightroom if you really want those pro features. Because I think while Apple may get there eventually, I think it's going to be a long time coming. And Apple has confirmed that aperture will be removed from the Mac App Store when the Photos app launches. So if you haven't purchased Aperture and you want a copy, you're going to want to buy it now, because anybody who's previously purchased Aperture will be able to continue to download it from the Purchases tab in the App Store. But once Photos hits for real, with the next version, and it seems like it's going to be out with the next version of OS X, no more Aperture on the Mac App Store. Now, you may get a little bit more time, because while Apple had said that iCloud Photo Library or the Photo app would be out in early 2013, the iCloud Photo Library beta FAQ was recently updated to say that the app was coming at a later date instead of early 2015. So that seems to indicate that Apple might be a little bit delayed. And it makes sense, because we're just seeing that beta version of the Photos app now. And we're already, you know, well into early 2015, moving into, you know, later 2015 at this point. So I would expect it to come out maybe right before the summer. And David Pogue said there will be a public beta of the Photos app coming in a couple weeks. So if you're not in the developer program and you want to get a look at the Photos application, you may have to just wait a week or two. Apple could put out a full public beta. And I don't know how that relates to people who signed up for Apple's OS X Yosemite public beta program. I would imagine you have an Apple developer account at this point, or you can log into the Apple developer connection, or maybe go through the beta website. I wasn't involved with that program, so I don't know exactly how it worked. But I'm curious, do you have access to the Photos application yet, or are you still waiting? Typically, it seemed like the public beta users were a couple weeks delayed, so that would jive with what David Pogue is saying. As far as other features and enhancements that have been noted in OS X 10.10.3 beta, It looks like there's better support for Google accounts that are using two-factor authentication. So when you go in to do that, the whole process is a little more streamlined. And then again, just like with the iOS 8 beta, there's a new emoji picker. It has a single scrolling pop-up window, and it has spaces, it looks like, for the new skin tone variants of emojis. So we had heard that Apple was going to expand and make more inclusive the kinds of emojis that you can pick. So you don't just have to have the yellow color guys. You're going to get more skin toned ones to be maybe a little bit more expressive and more representative of the community. So those are good things all around. And no word on when we'll see 10.10.3, but I would expect, again, it to include the Photos application. So it's sounding like maybe we should be looking for it later in the second quarter. Want to talk about this Apple mystery van? Yeah, I know it sounds like something out of the episode, an episode of Scooby-Doo. Can you imagine? I can see them ripping a latex mask off to reveal Eddie Q. And we totally would have gotten away with it, too, if it weren't for that meddling blogger and his crazy iPhone. What's going on with the Apple mystery van is there was a report from a CBS affiliate in Concord, California. A local news blog actually captured an image of a Dodge Caravan minivan driving around with this crazy camera contraption on the roof. And I guess they did a little bit of digging and discovered that the van was indeed leased to Apple. And that immediately led to all kind of speculation as to what the vehicle was and what it was doing. The local news blogger said that it looked similar to a self-driving Dodge Caravan, or a Dodge Caravan, rather, that was a self-driving car supposedly spotted in New York back in September of 2014. Now, to me, a more rational explanation that came out was that it was a Street View-like mapping project that Apple might be working on to kind of beef up Apple Maps. And we know that when Apple moved away from Google Maps, we lost the Street View functionality. Yeah, we gained the flyover feature, which is the cool 3D building stuff that Apple's doing, which is amazing from a technology standpoint. Really pretty to look at, but I never felt it was as practical as Street View. And I was hoping, and I have been hoping, that Apple would do a Street View thing. So when I saw this thing and heard some people speculating, oh no, this is part of Apple's mapping effort to improve Apple Maps, I thought, yeah, that's awesome. I really hope that's what they're doing. But tech analyst Rob Enderle, and I don't put a lot of stake in what Rob Enderle says all the time, but he was contacted by that CBS affiliate, and he agreed with the claim that the van was being used as a self-driving car project that Apple was working on. He claimed it had too many cameras to be used as a mapping effort, and the cameras were angled down at all four corners of the vehicle, and that led him to concur with the blogger. Now, needless to say, this stirred a ton of debate in the Apple community on all sides. The too many camera argument was thrown out in my book because, as Mac Rumors pointed out, the Google Street View vehicles use actually a 15 camera system, and this van had 12. And another thing that was thrown out was that Apple was not one of the six companies who are permitted to do testing of driverless cars in California. Now, Enderle dismissed that claim, saying that Apple might simply be partnering with one of the companies who does have one of those permits. And that seems logical to me. So if Apple is working on a self-driving car, they certainly could do that. But I don't know. I always fall on logic. And I think why would Apple want to build a self-driving car? What would be the benefit of that for Apple as a company? And I'm having a hard time seeing it, but maybe it's out there. I'm not going to totally dismiss it, but you know, we're going to talk about this, and I'm sure we'll be talking about this as more and more information comes out and as more and more people dig, because now that the seed's been planted, now that the image has been exposed, you know there's going to be a lot of people digging on this one, because it's fascinating, really. The vehicle also appeared to be fitted with a LiDAR sensor system, and unfortunately, that could be used both to make high resolution maps, and also is something that's used in many self-driving vehicle sensor systems. So that doesn't give us a whole lot of insight. Another thing that was noted, though, by Apple Insider readers is that these vans have been cited in a number of different places. Now, I think this is the first one to be tied back to Apple, but similar vans have been seen in Wisconsin, Hawaii, and even Panama City, Panama. And why that location? I have no idea. And then further adding to our Scooby-Doo mystery is Tesla CEO Elon Musk. He comes out just not long after these images come out and says that Apple's been trying to hire their engineers. They have actually been, you know, on headhunting missions, offering as much as $250,000 signing bonuses to bring Tesla engineers over to Apple. He claims it seems to be actually be working in reverse, though, that very few Tesla employees have actually jumped ship, and yet Tesla has hired over 150 of Apple's former employees. So it may not be working for Apple, but it still lends credence to, you know, why would Apple want Tesla engineers? Could it be for a car project? Maybe it adds some credence to the self-driving car rumors, but, you know, Tesla's also a lot about batteries. So battery technology, maybe in-car systems. They have some pretty neat in-car technology. So if Apple's looking to expand their CarPlay engineers, their battery engineers, batteries for iPhones, iPods, Apple Watches that need to literally sip battery life and have batteries that can make that watch go longer and longer. So there could be lots of reasons why Apple would want Tesla engineers. So I was fully kind of grooving on and digging and buying into, yeah, this is a mapping project thing and that's it. But then, of course, monkey in the works, Business Insider says that an Apple employee wrote to say that his group was working on something that would give Tesla a run for its money. And then Brian Chaffin over at the Mac Observer wrote a piece, and I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, claiming that his sources are 80% certain that Apple is working on a car, not just car-related technology, but an actual car. He asked point blank, and that was the response that he got. And, you know, I kind of have to kind of take that at face value and go, okay, Apple's working on a car. And then let that sit in your mind for a bit, right? It's like, whoa, you know, that's taking it to a whole new level. Apple likes to go into new markets. And I guess it's at the same level or maybe at a bigger level of epiphany as when we heard Apple was getting into the phone business, right? And Apple might not have to get much of the car business to actually make that a profitable business for them. Just like they did with the phone, they could be pulling off a similar thing. Now, is it a self-driving car? Maybe, maybe not. I think it's Apple experimenting, looking into a new market, looking where they might be able to make impact. But I'm still kind of baffled by the idea that maybe someday I'll be able to walk into an Apple car dealership and drive off in my white Apple car. Maybe they're doing flying cars. Maybe they're going to work on some anti-grav system or something like that. I mean, just your mind races to all kinds of sci-fi stuff. I would love to see Apple be the company that brings us finally the consumer-friendly flying car. Maybe that's too pie in the sky, but wouldn't that be awesome? Yeah, it would be awesome. All right, let's bring things back down to earth a little bit. Get back into the battle between Samsung and TSMC over Apple's next generation processor. We've been following this the past few episodes. It's been a back and forth battle. Lately, it seems like Samsung is winning, and this time Recode is reiterating, saying, yes, Apple is indeed turning back to Samsung for its A9 series production. They say the chips are expected to power Apple's new iPhones and iPads that'll be coming out in 2015. Really, the final blow in the battle seems to be that between TSMC and Samsung, it came down to the nanometers. So all about the nanometers. In December, it was reported that Samsung was actually already doing trial production runs of a new A9 chip design for Apple using their 14 nanometer process. We had also heard that TSMC was doing similar trial production runs, but their process uses 16 nanometers. So Samsung has them beat by 2 nanometers. And it's important because smaller nanometer processes tend to lead to more energy efficient and cooler running processors. both very, very good attributes to have in your mobile processors. Now, it's interesting to note that Apple's longtime chip partner, ARM, recently also announced a processor that's actually being built on a 16-nanometer design. So the nanometer technology that TSMC is using, it's the Cortex A72, and it's designed to run at up to 2.5 gigahertz. They're combining that with a new ARM Mali T880 GPU, and the company claims that the new mobile chip can bring console-class gaming performance to mobile. Now, that's something I think we arguably can say that Apple has with the A8 and technologies like Metal. So I don't think that's a huge leapfrog necessarily for ARM. And remember that since the A6, Apple really no longer uses stock ARM processors. They're still a partner, but they use their own designs and GPUs and then base their technology on the ARM instruction set. So they're basically ARM instruction compatible processors, but Apple is really doing its own custom silicon at this point. But it's interesting that ARM is also moving into the same nanometer production technology areas that Apple is, and Apple's going to still have them one-upped with Samsung using the 14-nanometer process. Now, KGI Securities analyst Ming-Chi Kuo says that Apple's next iPhone is going to feature also an improved Touch ID sensor, mainly targeted at giving a better Apple Pay experience as well as better security. So reducing the number of reading errors for an improved user experience. Frankly, I've been using Apple Pay quite a bit with my iPhone 6 Plus, and I've been very happy. Very few issues or misreads or anything like that. So anything that Apple can do to improve that experience and security, obviously very good, but I'm not sure how much they actually need it at this point. You know, I guess you always got to innovate a little bit and improve, right, from version to version. So that's a good thing. And then finally, Apple's big quarter numbers, those things just keep on giving, because it was noted that Apple accounted for 93% of the smartphone profits in the fourth quarter of 2014. That's according to Canaccord Genuity. So we knew Apple had impressive sales numbers, impressive profits. But in the smartphone industry, I think this is the largest chunk of industry profits that we've seen them take. I'll have to go back and double check, but 93%, that is pretty amazing. That's not leaving a whole lot left for the other companies that are out there. I think I read Samsung was right around that 7%. So everybody else is in that little bottom area of industry profits. So I think Apple did the right thing by targeting the higher end and going for that, don't you? One thing I think many of us have wondered about since Apple acquired Beats was, what is their long-term plan for the Beats music service? They continue to run it, obviously, and I think it's seen some minor improvements and updates and changes, but you know, what is the long-term plan? How is Apple going to integrate that into Apple, or will they even integrate it into Apple? Well, 9to5Mac says that Apple might finally be planning on bringing Beats music and the Beats music service to more users by offering deeper integration with its existing music software. They claim that Apple wants to integrate Beats Music into iTunes on the Mac and also into the Music app on iOS. They say the updated service could be available for Apple TV and maybe even Android as well. I think that would be a smart move on Apple's part. I don't think they want to take Beats away from Android users. They say the new service would still be subscription-based, but take on more of an iOS native look and feel. It would still be centered around the user's library, and it would still be a streaming music service. You'd be able to search and play any song in the Beats or iTunes music catalog. You'll be able to stream from the catalog or from your own music library. They're going to still have deep integration with the Beats music playlists, the activities, the mix features. All of that would be part of the new service. That gives the advantage of that human curation that Beats is really well known for in their music service. And current Beats users would reportedly be able to easily merge their accounts into their iTunes and Apple ID accounts so that they could bring all of their content and their playlists, all that sort of stuff with them into the new service. But the Beats itself, where the Beats music application would be losing its black and red design, taking on a more integrated iTunes music app feel. It would also continue to add on and improve on the social features for sharing music and playlists with friends. And as far as pricing goes, they're saying that Apple's new subscription-based service is expected to come at a cost of about $7.99 US per month. That would be a little bit lower than the current Beats music service, which I think is $9.99 US. And interestingly, the report says that Apple will continue to offer iTunes Radio as well as iTunes Match services, along with, of course, the iTunes Store and the new Beats offering. So it's not going to replace anything. It's going to be additive into that entire ecosystem. And I kind of get keeping iTunes Radio around because that's more of that Pandora style product. It's not like an a la carte streaming music service. But if I can access my entire library and the Beats music catalog, as well as the iTunes catalog and everything, I'm not sure why you need to keep around iTunes Match, except maybe the fact that iTunes Match just giving me access to what I have in my iTunes library comes at a lower price, right? It's $25 a year versus $7.99 a month. So it may be that there's sort of, you know, space to fill demand in all the different areas. But I think myself personally, I'd think long and hard about keeping iTunes Match and maybe going for the larger catalog and more access of something like an integrated Beats music service at $7.99 a month. What do you think? And then finally, we've been talking about a lot about what's next for Apple. Another question that logically follows that is, when are we going to see some announcements? What's the next Apple event? Now, some sites have been hinting that there's an upcoming Apple event to announce Apple Watch, maybe the iPad Pro, you know, that 12-inch iPad we've been hearing about, or maybe even those 12-inch MacBook Retina Airs, or maybe all the above. But dates and details right now are sketchy at best, but regardless, the rumors are out there stirring. Rumor is that there could be a MacBook Air refresh. This is coming from Apple Insider. They say we might see these on or around February 24th, but it's expected to just be a refresh of the line with new Intel Broadwell chips, and not that Apple would debut that rumored 12-inch Retina MacBook Air. So expect this to be more of a quiet update, no event or a big splash. And as far as what the processors might be, Apple could choose between the 2.2 core i5 processor, the 1.8 version, or maybe even all the way up to the 2 gigahertz variety or some sort of combination of those, but definitely moving into the Broadwell territory. We could still see a 12-inch Retina MacBook Air, but most folks don't think that's going to happen before March. So it's looking more like we might get some sort of Apple event in March. Maybe that's when Apple will announce the Apple Watch, give us an actual date, which Tim Cook has said is going to be sometime in April. And maybe we'll even get a look at a new iPad Air or a or iPad Pro or whatever we're calling it. And all those things could be sharing the spotlight at an event. But we don't have a firm date. Current signs are maybe pointing to sometime in March in advance of the Apple Watch in April. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Now I want to kick things off by playing a message that I received from Gary about getting some old iPhones ready for resale.
Hey Adam, it's Gary. I am actually unlocking a couple iPhones today, some ones to sell on Gazelle, and wasn't going to go through the whole process of unlocking because it's just painful for that extra $20. I don't know. It's a waiting game. It's plug it in, do all this stuff. So I ended up doing it. Two phones, $40 it looks like you get extra. So, but one of the other things I was going to mention is I was just testing out the Find My iPhone and the Lost versus Immediately Erase and stuff like that to see how it behaves. And I thought, you know, for a while that if you entered the Lost iPhone, it'll just send them, like, your message, like the owner wants you to call them, this is a lost phone, and you could potentially send it off to get erased if they don't do it. And they're like, well, that sucks. Great that your data is erased, but it loses the ability to locate it, so you kind of like, it's gone for good, and then they could just use it as a new phone. Well, I was surprised today to learn and see that once you do set it as lost and it gets erased, and it says on the screen, like, call the owner. If you don't do it, you can bypass it, go through the setup screen, but you can't actually set it up without that person's that set the lost email and password. So I was surprised that that was there. Not sure how easily that can be bypassed. I'm assuming not very easily at all. But I was just going to plug it in and unlock it in the computer, and it said you actually do need to enter that information to unlock it. And then if you press the help, it says if you receive this via resale, because I had not did the additional steps, it doesn't look any different. I wouldn't have known other than my test. So I wanted to share that with you, that I didn't realize that those additional safeguards are there, that once you do erase your phone or put it in lost mode and it's unrecoverable, that they basically can, after your data's out of there, just reset it and put their own stuff on there. But that's really not the case. They actually have to enter your Apple ID to actually get the use of that device.
Yeah. Hey, Gary, I probably should almost give you your own segment at this point. Thank you so much for continuing to send in your audio comments. I really appreciate that. And this one's a good one, because I think we've addressed this issue from the buyer side, sort of a cautionary tale saying, hey, make sure that you know when you go to buy a used device that the person you're buying it from has gone through the process of deregistering it, getting rid of those activation locks. But, you know, on the flip side of that, if you're getting ready to sell, we really should talk about maybe some of the stuff you should do. Now, before we get into that, I do want to make a mention. You mentioned the difficulty of actually getting a device unlocked. Good news is that starting today in the U.S., so it's, we're on February 11th, new law went into effect from the FCC saying that carriers have to unlock eligible phones. And AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, Sprint, Bluegrass Cellular, Cellcom, and U.S. Cellular have all already said they're on board. Carriers must respond to your unlock requests within 2 business days. So I don't know if that's any better than the delay that you experienced, but I know it could take weeks in the past. So they have to get on it more quickly, and they actually have to unlock those devices for you. So hopefully that process is not going to be as painful moving forward. And so it may make it more worthwhile to unlock your device so that you can get a little extra cash from a service like Gazelle. But getting back to what you were playing around with, this lost mode, what's cool about the lost mode now is, unlike sending the, you know, remote wipe, as you noted, if you just tell it to go remotely wipe the device, you immediately lose the ability to track it. With the new lost mode that they have in Find My iPhone, Find My iPad, Find My Mac, what'll happen is it'll immediately lock the device if you have a passcode on it, display a custom message on the screen, but continue to track its location when it hits, you know, open Wi-Fi hotspots and things like that. So the thing about it is, lost mode does require that you have the Find My iPhone Mac service turned on and activated on the device. So you're going to want to make sure that's turned on. Now, turning that on is also what activates the activation lock, and we'll talk more about that here in a minute. But I want to focus on the lost mode and sort of how that works. So what happens is that once you put that device into lost mode, it doesn't display alerts. It won't make any noise when you receive phone calls, messages, or notifications. None of your alarms will go off. So none of that stuff will get displayed on the lock screen, which is good for protecting your privacy and stuff like that. But it's not going to wipe your data. Everything's going to stay on there. Because you have the lock code on there, anytime you set a passcode on a device, all that stuff is encrypted on your device. So that's going to be protected. It doesn't really need to erase it. So the person's not going to be able to get in there. Another nice thing is if you have an iPhone 6 or 6 Plus and you have your credit cards in there in Passbook for Apple Pay, Find My iPhone is also going to immediately attempt to suspend your cards even if the phone is offline. So it's going to make it so those cards are disabled. They can't be used. I mean, you already have the Touch ID fingerprint sensor, but it's just another level of protection there. And then if you do get your device back, you can resume the suspended credit and debit cards by turning off the lost mode and then just signing back into your iCloud account. So Apple says this is suspending your cards. I don't think it's like calling your bank and suspending them. I think it's just on the device saying, okay, these cards aren't allowed to be used. You can't use these cards for Apple Pay. And then something to note, if you turn on lost mode on a Mac, with a Mac, you're not going to be able to locate it if it isn't near a previously used Wi-Fi network. So it's not just going to go out once it's in that lost mode and just attach to any open Wi-Fi network. You also, with a Mac in lost mode, lose the ability to erase it remotely. But I would assume you could just quickly take it back out of lost mode and then go into the remote wipe thing if you wanted to do that. But that's Mac only. On iOS, it's different. Now, like I said, with lost mode, what happens is if you already have a passcode on the device, it will just use that. If you haven't set a passcode on your device, once you turn on lost mode, it'll prompt you to put one in. So you can immediately put that in. It'll immediately lock it with that new passcode. And then, like I said, it has the activation lock on top of that. So anytime you enable Find My iPhone, that enables the activation lock feature. And what the activation lock feature does is, like you noted, it will not allow you to use or re-register or even erase that device without first putting in the Apple ID and passcode associated with that device. So the minute you turn it on, it will do that. So if you need to be able to resell your device, you need to make sure that you take some steps in order for the next person to be able to activate it, to turn off that activation lock feature. So what you need to do is you need to go into your device, make sure that you turn off Find My iPhone. You need to sign out of your iCloud account on your device, and then you need to erase and reactivate the device, basically set it up for resale. If you don't do all of those steps, the person who purchases your device is going to have a really hard time, if not an impossible time, activating it, because the activation lock feature is still going to be in place. And that's why, really, if you lose your device, putting it into lost mode is a better option while you're trying to track and recover your device. Because once you've kicked in that erase all content option, you're not going to be able to track it. And putting it into lost mode is going to keep it, you know, very well protected. Because as I noted earlier, with that passcode lock on, you have hardware encryption on every iOS device since the iPhone 3GS. So iPhone 3GS and later, iPad models, iPod Touch 3rd generation and later, all have hardware encryption. And when the passcode is on, all of your data is encrypted. So even if they were able to crack in there, which is going to be really hard without the passcode, even say they got in somehow and they got at the data on the device, it's all encrypted. So now they've got to break through all that encryption to even get at your data. So I almost think that doing a remote wipe really isn't necessary until you're absolutely 100% sure, yep, there's no way I'm ever recovering that device. So good point, and I'm glad you experimented around with that a little bit, because it gave us an opportunity to talk about it. So keep sending your audio comments, and, you know, if you have a question like Gary, you have a comment, anything, you can send me email or an audio comment, send them to maccast@gmail.com. Now I have a little quick tip for you. It's actually based on something, an issue that I've had recently when I've been searching for help on Apple's support articles. I usually go into Google and I'll Google for, you know, some solution, and very often links to Apple's discussion boards or Apple's support articles come up. And what's been happening to me lately is very often when I click through to read one of those articles, all I get is a blank screen, just a blank white screen. You check the URL looks fine, and it didn't happen every time for me. So I was kind of curious, what's going on here? Well, I read somewhere that there is a small bug sometimes in Safari with Apple's support pages where they just show up blank because of your Apple cookie. I don't know specifically what the scenarios are, but it can happen. And so just simply clearing the Apple cookies in Safari should fix it. And I tried this the last time I got a blank page, and it totally worked for me. So I thought I'd share the solution for you just in case, or with you just in case you've run across this. So in Safari, if you just go into Preferences and then click on the Privacy tab, then you'll see a button that says Remove All Website Data. Wait a second, and then you'll probably see appear a smaller Details button just kind of under it and to the right. Click on that Details button, and then it will bring up a list, and there's a search field there. You can search for the domain apple.com, so just type apple.com in there, and what it'll do in the results is show you just the apple.com cookies and data. And so select that item from the list, and then you can click the Remove button followed by the Done button. And that's going to remove just the apple.com cookies. And at that point, you can close the Preferences window, reload that support article, and it should load just fine for you. Now, of course, you could use less steps and just go into the Safari menu and choose the Clear History and Website Data option, then select All History and clear everything. But then you lose cookies and data for every site that you visit. I like to go into the Privacy tab and under the Details and do it site by site, because I think it's, you know, a little more surgical, a little more precise. I don't want to, you know, blow away my Google cookies or, you know, the other remembered logins that I have if I don't have to. So if you've run across this support article, you know, blank white screen thing, that's how you can fix it. Another thing that happened to me recently that I wanted to share with you is I was troubleshooting a sync and storage issue on an iPad mini. So I was connecting it into iTunes to sync over some data, and it would go through the entire process, and then it would get stuck on updating data. And so I was troubleshooting that, and I found some steps and some things to try to kind of rejigger it and reset it, and one of the methods was to go in and remove all of the music and media files from the iPad and then resync that stuff over from iTunes. So you'd go into the iPad itself, go into the usage area, delete all of those files directly on the device, and then resync everything back. And I had connected the iPad, you know, first into iTunes, and I'd pulled a backup and I'd synced any data. And at the time, it did warn me that this iPad had purchase content that wasn't synced to the Mac, but I figured since I was going through the syncing operation and backup, I'd be fine, right? So everything's backed up. And then I go in and I remove the content from the device. I did a few other resets, and I proceeded to then sync my data back from iTunes. And everything seemed to go perfectly fine until I went into the settings for audiobooks and went to resync the audiobooks. And sure enough, they weren't there in iTunes. It just took me to the audiobooks section of the store. They weren't showing up in my library. And because I had purposefully removed them from the iPad, they were gone. And I'm guessing that's where where it was warning me, hey, you have unsynced data, unsynced purchases on this iPad that aren't in your iTunes library. And I hadn't realized that. And then I thought, well, that's no big deal, right? Because I'll just re-download those audiobooks from the iTunes store. Well, guess what? Nope. Audiobooks and ringtones are a special kind of content in the iTunes universe, and they are not re-downloadable. Now, to be fair, there are warnings and restrictions that are easy to find if you do a little searching where you can learn about this restriction, but I had somehow missed that, you know, so it comes down to licensing and all that other stuff. We don't have to get into that nitty-gritty. The point you need to know is audiobooks are not re-downloadable, and you know, Apple always warns us about this. They say, make sure any purchase content you back up. And so luckily I was able to go through my order history, find my original order numbers for the four audiobooks that were missing. I contacted Apple support, iTunes support, store support through a chat session, and they were able to help me actually recover the audio files. But it was a bit of a hassle, and I wouldn't want you to have to go through that. So there's some good things to know where you can kind of better protect yourself. And the first place I went wrong was actually transferring your audiobook and ringtone purchase content from iTunes. It's not just part of the regular sync process. So what you need to do if you've purchased that stuff, and this is what happened, is I had purchased that stuff directly on the iPad, not on iTunes. If I had done it on iTunes, they would have been in my iTunes library and I would have been syncing them over. But because I had purchased them directly on the device, you need to go through a process to actually copy that back into your iTunes media folder. And the way you do that is you go connect the device to iTunes with the sync cable. You select the device and then go under the file menu under devices in iTunes 12 and choose transfer purchases from and the name of the device. You'll see that selection there. When you do that, that'll go through and anything that you've purchased directly on the device that isn't in your iTunes library already is going to get transferred over. And it gets put in the, you know, the home folder, the music folder, iTunes media folder. And then in the case of audiobooks, right, they're inside an audiobooks folder. So you can go look in there, make sure that everything transferred back over. And then, of course, you're going to want to make sure you take the contents of that folder and make sure it's part of your backup plan. So if you're using Time Machine or Super Duper or Crash Plan or whatever it might be, make sure you back that stuff up. And you may even want to put an archive version of anything that you purchase, say, onto a USB drive. I think that's a generally good thing to do. So if you're buying movies, you're buying things like that, put them on an external hard drive, some sort of archive backup. And the reason that you want to do that is because if you do not back up your iTunes purchases, a few things can happen. One, the content, you know, might accidentally get deleted. You might lose it. Another thing to be aware of is that things that are purchased on the iTunes store, there's no guarantee, even if you could re-download them, so things like music and movies and TV shows, there's no guarantee that Apple is going to have those titles in perpetuity, right? Forever. They do deals. They get licensing changes. They, you know, contracts run out. So it's not guaranteed that it's going to be there in the future. You're going to want to make sure that the copy that you bought is the copy that you keep. So back that stuff up. You also want to make sure that you download stuff because sometimes different versions come out or Apple replaces a version that they might have. And that's happened to some of our listeners. So you wouldn't want that to happen to you either. And then, you know, lastly, this goes for apps as well. You know, apps change. They come and go. Some get pulled. I have some apps that I've backed up that Apple literally pulled from the store. They're no longer around, but I still have my copies so I can actually re-download and install them. So what I do is I have one computer where I download everything. And even though I'm on iTunes Match and an iTunes Match subscriber, I make sure I pull down all of my music to that computer. I pull down all of my movies. Those movies eat up a lot of storage, you know, 800 gigabytes of storage, but I have an external drive that I store my library on. Everything goes onto there, and then that drive is actually backed up to Adrobo locally over the network using ChronoSync, and it's also part of my Crash Plan backup, so it gets backed up to the cloud as well. So I make sure I have copies everywhere. How I missed the audiobooks, you know, it was just a matter of I didn't realize they didn't get synced back. Now that I know and now that you know, there should be no excuse for us losing our audiobooks anytime in the future. So wanted to make sure that you didn't get caught up by that one. Now, here's another cool little trick. Like I said, I'm getting ready to go on this trip, and we're going to be taking our devices with us. And one of the things that we want for content when we're on the plane is movies. And the thing is that if you have an iPad, especially if you have a 16 gigabyte or maybe even a 32, space is precious on that device, as you know. And you know, especially if you have a smaller screen device, even if you've purchased HD movie content, you might not want to take up all that room on your device. You might want to go for a lower resolution, a smaller SD version. And one way that you can get at that is in iTunes, you can adjust your settings before you download and sync your movies to your device. You can go into the iTunes preferences under store, and there's an option that says when downloading high-definition videos, prefer, and you have the option of 1080p or 720p. Now, obviously, 720p is what I call the smaller pseudo HD version. It's going to be a little bit smaller than the 1080p, but probably not a whole bunch smaller. So what if you want even smaller than that? Well, what you could do is you could connect your device to iTunes, and then on the device itself, go in, you know, select the device in iTunes, go to the summary pane on that device, and there's a little checkbox that says prefer standard definition videos, that option. And if there's a standard definition version available, it's going to sync that over in lieu of the HD version. But I've played around with this a little bit, and I very often still end up with the larger HD version of a lot of my content. So I was looking for the ultimate way to make sure that I was only getting the smaller SD version directly on my device. And I discovered you can actually do it directly without having to sync if you know what to do. It's not just as simple as going into your purchase library in the iTunes Store app and downloading from there. What you have to do is start by going into the movies section of the iTunes Store and then searching for or browsing for the movie that you already know, own that you want to download. And I find that searching for it is probably the easiest way to find it. So, for example, if I wanted to put the SD version of The Hobbit on my iPad, I would go to my iPad, I would launch the iTunes Store, I would search for Hobbit in the movies section, and I would click on that, and then immediately you'll see the little cloud download icon instead of the buy button. Don't click on that. So remember, we're not in the purchase section. We're in the regular iTunes Store. Don't click on that because that's the HD version by default. Instead, scroll to all the way to the bottom, go way down to the bottom, and you should see if an SD version is available, a link that says also available in SD. Click on that link, and then that will load the SD version of that movie page. You'll see the little cloud icon again that you can download. Click on that, and then the much smaller, about half-sized SD version of the film will download. So, for example, Big Hero 6 was recently released. I have that in my library. I wanted to put that on this iPad. The full HD version was, I think, 3.6 gigabytes. The SD version, 1.4 gigabytes. So I can load a lot more movies onto my iPad if I go for the SD version. Yeah, I'm giving up a little bit of quality, but on a smaller screen, especially on something like an iPad mini or an iPhone, probably not going to matter that much, and I'd rather save the space. So I thought that was a good little trick that I found and wanted to share that with you. Now, another thing that I told you about at the top of the show that a lot of us struggle with, and David wrote in to express a frustration with, was slow motion video on iOS. This is a great feature in iOS, and it's not a frustration with the feature. It's an awesome feature, and especially if you have the 240 frames per second that you get on the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, it is awesome. You can go in, you can watch super slow-mo videos. It's amazing, fun stuff to watch, but you can get some frustration coming in as you try to share that slow motion video, or worse, bring it back and use it on your Mac. In David's case, what he noticed was he had been on a trip, he had shot a bunch of slow motion video, loved watching it on his device, but when he synced all of that back to his Mac for backup purposes and then played it on his Mac, the slow motion effect wasn't there. You lose the slow motion effect. So basically what's happening is when you transfer it over, it transfers over the high frame rate video. So if it was shot at 120 or 240, you're going to get all of that, all those frames, but they're played back at full speed using things like QuickTime or iPhoto. When you're viewing them in there, you're seeing that actual video at full frame rate. It's not keeping those metadata markers that show or tell the system, hey, switch over to the slow-mo playback at this point and then come back out of slow-mo. And so you're losing that. They play just like normal video when you copy, export, or transport them over to the Mac. Like I said, all the frames are still there, but what you'll have to do back on the Mac is you'll have to use a tool like iMovie to actually reapply the effect. To make it even more confusing when you're on the iOS device is when you export to a service like YouTube, it actually does preserve the slow motion effect. And that's because it's actually exporting the video out of the application. It's actually creating a copy of it as it uploads. It's not the raw source video. When you're backing it up to your Mac or sharing in some other methods, you're actually getting that raw high frame rate video. So I wanted to share with you the way I get around this, David. I use a free app on my iPhone called True Slow-Mo. And I say free. Actually, they have a pro upgrade. You're going to want to get the pro version. It's only 99 cents. The main difference is with the free version, I think you can only set the start point for your slow-mo video and not the end point. And with the pro version, you also get the ability to put in multiple slow motion sections within a single video. So pretty simple app to use. What you do is you open up the app. It will display any slow motion videos that you have in your camera roll or library. It'll let you open those up, and it has its own little built-in editor. It'll already have the slow motion start and end points in place that you set in the Photos application. And then you can adjust those. Like I said, the free version lets you adjust the start point, but not the end point. The pro version lets you put in start and stop points as well as multiple slow-mo locations. And once you've got everything set up the way you like it, you tap done in the app. And what it'll do is it'll process the video with the slow motion effects intact and then save that video back to your camera roll. So you'll end up with a second copy, but then you'll have a version that you can sync back to your Mac, you can export, you can save out, you can put into other applications, and it will keep all of the slow motion video intact. At the end, it also gives you access to a share sheet so you can share it out on social media, post it to Instagram, things like that. You can also export it and throw it over to other applications. Really handy app. It can sometimes take a while to export that slow motion video. Has to do a lot of processing there on your iOS device. And even on a new device like the iPhone 6 Plus, I found it can be a little bit slow, but works really well. And I've been using the app for a while. So check that out as one solution. I know there's other apps out there. If you have another suggestion or a way for handling this, share it with us. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally in the show for today, Jim is a switcher. He's moved over from Windows. I'm not really sure how frequently he sent me an email, but he asked me to share my thoughts about Macs and antivirus software, and really to talk about it from a practical method, you know, not to get too crazy or, you know, when you start talking about antivirus on the Mac, there can tend to be this sort of, you know, holy war of people who say, oh, no, never do antivirus. You know, we don't want to get into the extremes here. He also said, you know, could I possibly recommend some antivirus software for people who decide they actually want to run something on the Mac? So I don't subscribe to the camp of, oh, no one should have antivirus on their Mac. I am, you know, more on the side of, I don't think for most people it's very necessary. And I know I've covered my thoughts on this topic here and there on the MacCast, but I thought, you know, this was a good time and a good opportunity to have another real discussion about this, because I think it's been a while since we've talked about it wholeheartedly. And I guess the first place I want to start is, you know, I want to like get past the myth of, oh, Macs don't get viruses or malware, that they're not targets of attack. A Mac can have and will be a target of attacks and malware. It happens. It's not unheard of. It's rare. Yes, I'll give you that. But if you look throughout history, it does happen from time to time. You know, some people are saying Apple's growing popularity. There's more Macs out there. They're becoming a bigger target. You know, that, while true, I think there's perspective to be brought in there as well. Apple is growing its PC share, but it's still really a drop in the bucket when you look at the whole ecosystem compared to things like PCs running Windows. So I don't think we're at much, you know, much bigger risk. And I think there's multiple reasons for that. It's not just that, you know, we don't have a huge market share. There's other things going on. And specifically, Apple has done a lot in recent years to really do what they call harden the operating system, basically protect it from attacks. There's a number of technologies and things that Apple has added in that, you know, I think add to the fact that it's just a hassle to try and target a Mac for these exploits. Apple has Gatekeeper in place that is going to reduce the risk of being tricked into installing malware. A lot of times the way this stuff gets in is through Trojans, right? Code hidden inside other code that gets into your system. Well, Apple makes developers sign their apps. They have to go through registration. You know, there's barriers in place. It's not to say stuff can't slip in, but it's a lot harder to do. And users are warned, if you picked up a piece of software or suddenly something tried to install on your system and it wasn't signed, Gatekeeper's going to step in and it's going to protect you. It's going to warn you. It's going to actually stop that from actually being able to get in and infect your system. Then on top of that, you have sandboxing in apps, which limit what they can do. So even if a piece of malware got in there, it's going to be restricted in terms of the kinds of access it has to low levels of the operating system. So it's a lot harder to get in and exploit. Apple does not include Java installed by default. You don't get that on your system unless it's needed. A lot of malware is written for Java and it comes in that way, or Flash. You know, with Apple apps like Flash, if they're known to have a problem, they can be remotely disabled. And Apple's done this recently with some zero-day Flash exploits. They just said, okay, we're going to turn Flash off for now until the patch comes out. And so they have those protections in place. And Apple has also become pretty good about addressing and updating security problems with patches. They're not always the best. They, you know, sometimes they take longer than we wish they would take, but they do a fairly good job maintaining that and keeping us at a fairly good level of protection. So we have all of that going for us. Now let's talk a little bit about antivirus software and what it does and how it works. The typical way most antivirus software works is it uses signatures. It uses known bits of code and malware code and exploits to kind of scan for and look for patterns in things that get installed on your operating system. So it kind of has to know about a virus before it can really detect it and protect you from it. And so that's great if it's already an existing virus or some sort of variant, but a lot of times what hackers are really trying to do is have what's called zero-day exploits, things that the antivirus and anti-malware companies don't know about, brand new code, stuff that hasn't been seen before. And so antivirus software is not necessarily very good at protecting you against that. They can kind of, again, look for patterns and add some smarts to it, but, you know, it's not really, really great. And so if you keep your system up to date and you avoid some of the pitfalls of malicious software, you know, phishing scams that come in through email, malicious sites, you can actually stay fairly safe, I think, without any antivirus software installed on Mac or Windows. You know, if you follow these procedures and do these things, you know, it's becoming less and less necessary, I think, for a lot of people. There's also additional steps you can do to stay safe. For example, to avoid phishing scams or malware or viruses coming in through email, you could use a service that has protections on the server side. So Google, Yahoo, iCloud, you know, Apple Mail, they all filter this stuff on the server before it even gets to you. So if they find malware or something like that, they're not even going to send those messages along to you. Another step you can take is use a DNS service like OpenDNS that detects and blocks known malicious websites. So if you try to visit a site that's known to contain malware or viruses or things that could potentially infect your computer, it's going to block you from even going there, or at least warn you and say, look, this site is suspicious. You probably don't want to visit it. So there's a lot of protections and steps you can take without putting antivirus software on your system. And really, the problem most people have with antivirus software is it's an active piece of software. It has to be running in the background, constantly scanning things and files and stuff that's coming in and out of your system to really be effective. You could set it up for nightly scans if you want to minimize that stuff and sort of schedule it. But really, most people, if they're worried about it, they're looking for that kind of active protection. So I think with all the other things that are going on, most people probably don't need an antivirus software on their Mac. But if you do decide, hey, this is something I want, and you know, one big argument for it that people make that I'll go along with is sometimes people just want to be responsible citizens. You know, you're sharing files with other users. Maybe they're on PCs and Windows, and while your Mac doesn't get infected by that stuff, you could receive files that have malware or viruses in them, and you could end up unknowingly sort of being a carrier or being a person that passes along that from one user to another. And maybe you want to nip that in the bud and not pass that stuff along. So I think that's a good reason to maybe want to install it. Or maybe you're running an older version of Mac OS X and you're not getting software updates anymore. At a certain point, Apple stops putting out updates and security patches. So maybe you want that, or maybe you just want the peace of mind of having antivirus and knowing nothing's getting on your system. Well, you do have some good options. Jim, since you asked, I would recommend Sophos, which is free, Avast, which is another product that's free, or check out ESET Cybersecurity. I think that one's $39.99 a year. And this is an important thing. You want a antivirus system where they're pushing out updates to that library, because as I said, you know, they're going to be looking for those signatures. So you want to make sure you're getting updated what they call definitions, or basically those bits of code that it's going to look for, so it knows new viruses are detected and things come out, new malware is out in the wild, that it's going to be able to recognize those things. So I'll have links to all of those in the show notes at maccast.com. But I hope that kind of helps address your question and your concern. And, you know, it's really kind of a personal choice. Don't let anybody tell you that you absolutely don't need it. If you feel like it's something that you want, there's a lot of good options out available for the Mac. And, you know, a couple of them are really good and they're free. So it really doesn't hurt. You can always install it, run it, see if it helps you, see if you like it. If it's causing problems on your system, take it off and don't use it. I think no harm done. So that's kind of my take on it. Again, I'm sure others have opinions. If you do and want to share your opinion, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, as well as PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all their great software, get more information and details by going to smilesoftware.com. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. Lynda.com. Lynda helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free trial for 10 days by going to lynda.com/maccast. That's lynda.com/maccast for your free trial. And, of course, Audible. If you want to get a great book to listen to, Audible has it. They have over 150,000 titles in virtually every genre, so you know you can get what you're looking for. You can get a free audiobook and a 30-day trial today by signing up at audiblepodcast.com/maccast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They're at backbeatmedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, as I've mentioned throughout the show, you can shoot your email to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. Also, you can leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype name is The MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of The MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. Be sure to check out the forum while you're there at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page at facebook.com/themaccast. And we also have a Google Plus community. If you're on Google Plus, just search for MacCast and you will find us there. Look forward to seeing you online, but until next time, that'll do it, and we'll talk to you all again real soon.